Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, January 29, 2026. Looks like we have just about everyone here. We've got Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Representative Schrage, Co-Chair Representative Josephson, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stepp, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. We have one bill before the committee this afternoon. If we have time, we will, and the I believe that Mr. Alexei Painter has got another engagement, but if he gets out early and we have time later, he'll come back to finish up with his presentation on the governor's FY27 budget and his assessment of that budget. So with that, we have one bill before us right now, and that's Senate Bill 64. It's the elections bill. We are going to adopt a new version, hear the changes made to the bill, take questions, and then we'll set the bill aside. So what I'd like to start with first is maybe just we could have committee substitute for Senate Bill 64, Co-Chair Schrage, if I could ask you to maybe introduce the motion just to put before us the CS. Co-Chair Schrage?
Yeah, happy to, Chair Foster. I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 64, Work Draft 34-LS0153/U, dated 1/28/26 is our working document.
Thank you. I'm going to object, and I'll also object for the purposes of getting the explanation and ask my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson, if you could come up and explain the changes. I think if we could maybe just get through the explanation of changes between the prior version of this bill and this new CS, and then we'll go to questions. So, with that, Mr. Anderson, if you could put yourself on the record. Also, looks like maybe I'd like to invite Mr. David Dunsmore to the table to also maybe be available to take questions. I see him right there. And so with that, Mr. Anderson, if you could go ahead and kick us off here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. This CS has more sections and items removed from the bill than added. The co-chair office has provided every member with a redline version of the bill from the current version in front of the committee, which is version L.A, to this new version, which is version U. I will try to reference both the old sections that have been removed, which are reflected in the red line as blue and also have been struck through. Then I will also try to explain the current sections that have only been changed from previous sections. So if I don't reference a section in my walkthrough, that is because it's the current language that you've seen throughout every iteration of this bill. Beginning... The title has changed to reflect the changes made in this version of the bill, and then the rest of the CS has been remunerated to reflect the removal of those old sections. So jumping right in, old section number one has been removed. This was the section that had made changes to the residence requirements. Jumping down to new section four, this changes the timeline to 28 months, which in previous versions had either been reflected as two general elections in some places and also or 2 years. That also removes the hunting and fishing license, out-of-state tuition, and physical residence from the disqualifier list for voter maintenance efforts and cleaning up rolls.
I think... We're hoping that we can get through the summary of changes, but if you've got a quick technical, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I did have a technical question about how we're walking through the information you're trying to provide us. So initially you said Section 1 has been removed, old Section 1. That would be from working draft LA. Section has been removed. Then you said skipping to Section 4, and you said new. So I'm not sure if you mean under – I'm looking at it. I have four items in front of me. I have two sectional analysis, and then I have two bills. One is the working draft bill that has the red lines. One is the final version of the bill. Then I have the old LA version of the bill. So as we're skipping through this, we went from old Section 1 removed to new Section 4. So when I'm looking at the sectional analysis, I skip down. So I just wanted to understand, like, how you're walking through the bill when we're actually going through this so that I can follow along without having to interrupt.
That's a great question, Representative Bynum. Thank you. Mr. Anderson, if you could maybe slow down a little bit, make sure that if you're referring to different documents, if you could point that out. But Representative or Mr. Anderson?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative, the best way I think the committee could follow along is to reference the red line version of the bill. That will probably be the easiest way to track. I will make sure my tempo is not rushed and allow you to find some of those new sections. Many of the red line version of the bill, you will see whole entire pages that are blue and struck through, and then you'll see off to the side on the left side, you'll see sometimes where a section number has a strike through and then the new section number is there. So I will try to pause long enough for you all to find those sections. So,
and if folks do need us to kind of point something out, feel free to jump right in and ask for that clarification. So Mr. Anderson.
Starting again at new Section 4, these changes are the timeline that changes it to 28 months from what was either referenced as two general elections or 2 years. Then further along in that new section, it removes the hunting and fishing licenses, out-of-state tuition, and physical residence from the disqualifiers, a disqualifier for the voter list maintenance efforts when Division of Elections is cleaning up voter rolls. And then you're going to see throughout much of this, or almost the entire new version of the CS, that all of the references to hunting and out-of-state hunting and fishing licenses have been removed from a disqualifier. Jumping down to new Section 6. New Section 6 changes the time requirement to 34 months, which in the previous version had been fourth calendar year. Jumping down to new Section 8. This adds further requirements for review when Division of Elections are updating their master registry. And the review of information will include now the Systemic Alien Verification Entitlement Program, whether or not they've served on a jury in another state or have benefited in some other way from another state. It also here removes the out-of-state hunting and fishing licensing. And then this also allows the division to make a determination if they can reasonably prove that the person has been out of state. This section before in previous versions had been the authority of the director and now has been pushed to a Division of Election rather than the director. Next, we're going to examine the removal of old section number 10. This was an earlier edition of the procedures for the canceling of voter registrations. The new Section 10 now retains the previous version of the addition of what we call the rural community liaisons. Looking at the next two sections that were removed from the old Section 13, this removed earlier additions of poll workers and observers for ballot counting in a facility. And then also old Section 14 was removed, and this was referencing the Alaska Public Office Commission, or APOC, to have an office in every Senate district. Looking at new Section 11, this section is often referred to as the true source clarification section. And you're going to notice in later on in the bill, there will be a section later that makes the effective date for this clause directly January 1, 2027. We have also removed old section number 18. This section was the posting of notices of language assistance. And then in new section 14, this section is amended to also remove the current utility bills, bank statements, or government checks from the list of acceptable identifications. Old section 20 is removed, and then we're also amending what would be new section 15. The combination of the removal of that old section and then the amendment of the new section removes references to ranked choice voting and preserves the current regulations for observers by removing additional requirements made in previous editions of this bill. New section 17 adds a requirement that all absentee ballots include a postage paid return envelope, and it also, and I'll say this slowly, removes the repeal of witness signature. So witness signature will still be a requirement moving forward. Old section 23 and in section 24 are removed. These remove the previous changes to candidate and campaign observers and also the removal of risk-limiting audits. Old section, and this is going to be a few page turners, old sections 26 through 30, all of those sections are removed, and that removes the sections regarding security measures for special need ballots. Section 18 amends this section is to amend the current, to remove all current utility bills, bank statements, and governments from the list of acceptable identifications in section 18.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Just real quick, Mr. Anderson, what page is that on? Because I'm not finding a section 18. I'm on page 18, former section 31. I was with you till there. And it might be helpful if you just give us pages when you're giving us that section when there's a lot of drops.
It's missing. It's missing the number.
So, through the chair, it is very unique the way this it is drafted. If you'll see on page 15, you'll see on line 22 the word SEC dot, and then everything is struck through until you get to page 17. And then starting at page 17, line 26, you'll see a hanging chad of 18. That is your section 18 start. They continue to remove all items that were previously mentioned in that removal of that section until we get down to line 16 of page 18, and then everything following is the rest of section 18.
For the record, Mr. Co-Chair, that's where I followed you to, and then I thought, am I missing section 18? No, it's just that it's a hanging chad earlier. Okay, so section 18 starts on page 18, line 16, for all of its content, but its titling is spread over two pages. We love Ledge Legal.
This hanging chad is very apropos to the discussion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Starting on page 19 of your red line. Oh, excuse me. This is where I will go a little sideways. We can jump to trying to line up page numbers. We will jump back, excuse me. If we can jump back to page 19, the removal of Section 33 on line 13. That section removes the section that allowed voters to register to continue to receive absentee by mail ballots as long as the voters had cast a ballot once every four years. So that section has been removed. Looking ahead to pages 20 through page 22, we have two new sections, section 22 and 23. Before I refer to the sections that have been removed, new section 22 and 23 maintains what is known as ballot curing. In your blue line, you will see a red line, you'll see a bunch of sections removed. Those are sections 36 and 37, which removes the tracking barcode requirement for witness signature and regulation requirements for challenging ballot review. Also, jumping ahead to page 24, what is known as old section 41, starting at line 16, removing old section 41 removes the requirement to adopt regulation for security standards of drop boxes, which essentially preserves what is currently in regulation. Now, starting at the bottom of page 26, line 31 of your red line, old sections 45 through 50 are removed. And by removing these sections, it removes the requirement that Lieutenant Governor develop a cybersecurity program and the prohibition of undisclosed use of synthetic media. It also removes the codification of the settlement of ACLU of Alaska versus the state of Alaska. And finally, it removes all portions previously listed of APOC's reporting requirements. So collectively, those sections remove those things from the previous version of the bill. Starting on page 31, down towards the bottom on line 27, we have a new section 29. And this new section, in conjunction with old sections 51, 52, and 55, the removal of those three sections removes all PFD application requirements except for what's listed in section 29, which requires the Department of Revenue to share voter information gathered from the PFD applications. There were quite a bit of regulations and new requirements for the PFD applications regarding voting, and those have been removed with this final thing remaining. We have a new section 31, starting on page 32, line 26. This section is amended to remove additional conforming repeals related to poll watcher provisions that are removed from this. So previous iterations had poll watcher regulation provisions in there, and this removes that. New section 34, which begins at page 33, line 21. This makes sections 23 and 24 of the new version of the bill conditional on both sections taking effect. So there are conditional language to connect those two sections together for the passage of the bill. New section 35, which is page 33, line 27. This is the effective date mentioned earlier for section 11, which is January 1st, 2027. And then finally, new section 36 is the effective date of July 1st, 2026 for the remainder of the bill There are also technical and conforming languages that are done to clean up the bill through the different iterations. And then, Mr. Chairman, this completes the statement of changes for CS version U.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Got two quick questions, small one first. Postage paid, what page was that on?
It was new section 17, which is found, I believe the representative is correct.
Essentially page 15, I think. So I like to kind of try to simplify things as much as possible, and especially for folks maybe watching who have not had a chance to actually look at the bill in detail or just seeing this for the first time. And I guess if I was a person on the street just telling somebody, you know, the 10-second version of what this bill does, and so feel free, I actually haven't asked my staff this, I would probably say what this bill does, the big things are it's ballot curing. It allows people to fix their vote if through some technicality their ballot got thrown out, they can fix it. The witness signature stays in. That's a requirement. Postage is paid. And as a rural guy, I like having a real rural liaison. So just kind of a real high level, like this is kind of what the big things of the bill are. Would you add anything else? Do I have that correct in terms of what's in there? And is there anything else that you might add?
Through the chair, I think that is a very high-level synopsis of the major changes that have happened. It does remove some of the things that had been debated in previous iterations, observer powers and things like that, poll workers and things like that. But overall, that's a good summary.
And I might ask Mr. Dunsmore maybe the same question. I know you've put a lot of time into this, and is there, if you're trying to just tell somebody what the 10-second version of what this bill is, how would you describe it?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Wilkowski. As you can tell from Mr. Anderson's explanation of the changes, this version is pared down a bit from the version that passed the Senate and was heard by this committee previously. But kind of the top level things are focusing provisions focused on improving election integrity with the ballot curing, ballot tracking, expediting the process for cleaning up our voter rolls, and adding more indicators of residency in another state to the trigger the voter roll cleanup process, as well as provisions to speed up the certification and release of election results.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, I would invite the members of the committee, if you have questions. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. I don't really have a question. Can I just make a statement, or do you want me to wait since I was one of them who objected to it?
I guess I am. Well, yeah. No, I'm doing this correctly. I thought I was skipping a step here. Go ahead and ask a question. Representative Bynum, did you have the next question, I think? Okay. So Representative Ballard.
Okay. So, Chair, I just wanted you to know it's more of a statement on it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So I appreciate this coming forward, and I appreciate it for numerous reasons. One of the reasons is because I really think that the public would enjoy me going line by line, destroying this bill, because it absolutely violates what I would consider people's constitutional rights. It discriminates against individuals who don't live in the rural communities. I would also say that it is something that if you vote for it or support this CS, that it is somebody saying that I support ranked choice voting. And that is what this bill does. I would also add that this hurts, doesn't fix elections. And I would disagree on the reasons of the ballot curing or the voter roll, because it doesn't go far enough. There are many things that I do agree on that I will compromise on, and I'll work with other members of my body and of the other body, and elections isn't one of them. And I'm not going to really say anything further other than I really want this to go forward so that we can get all our amendments in and that the public can really understand what this bill means line item by line item. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
May I say with that,
sure.
Can I withdraw my
objection at this moment, or would you like me to hold off?
You can object. My objection will still be
right.
In
so
place.
I'll withdraw mine. And
okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. So we'll do questions, and then once we're through questions, and folks feel like they've got a good understanding of just the bill in general, not that we're approving it at this point, but once we go through that process, then we will put it to a vote as to whether or not we're adopting the CS. And so we're going to go to Representative Bynum. And again, the CS is just putting it on the table so that we can continue with the process with public testimony and so forth. Representative Bynum, Representative Stapp, was anybody else in the queue? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And this is just more of a procedural question. We obviously have the CS in front of us. We have an explanation on it. There's many items within the CS, the bill as a whole, that I'd like to get a little bit further questions into and how the mechanisms of the bill will work. But I'm assuming that at this time is not the time to do that. I mean, I'm assuming I can, but we will have another opportunity, if I'm not mistaken, to actually come back and go through each section of this bill once, you know, the cleanup version of the bill, meaning adopting a CS if that happens, and to be able to actually take some time to really dive into some of these things. Is that accurate?
You're absolutely correct.
All right. So with that, I'm not going to be asking any additional questions at this time. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify.
Great. Thank you. Representative Stapp, and then Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, my question's super immaterial, Chair. I was just going to say my red line version is primarily blue rather than red, and I've just never seen that before, and that's it. So thanks.
Thank you. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. To the chair. Question to the co-chair, actually. Now, I believe you said that the postage was left in there, but I thought Mr. Anderson said that the postage was taken out. So I just wanted to clarify what I heard.
Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative. paid postage is still in there. If I misspoke, I apologize to the committee for that. The paid postage portion of it is found on page 15, starting at lines 2 through essentially line 21, where you see the paid postage there listed. So it is still currently in the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, does the committee have any further questions? And again, this is SB 64. We're on version U. I don't see any further questions. Mr. Anderson, am I missing anything other than adopting the CS?
Mr. Co-Chairman, no. That's the next.
I will go ahead and remove my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting version U of SB 64? Seeing none, version U is adopted. And so with that, thank you very much for the rollout and the introduction of the new version of the bill, Mr. Dunsmore and Mr. Anderson. So it looks like we may have time for Mr. Alexi Painter to finish his presentation regarding the assessment of his analysis of the governor's bill. However, I think he may not be ready yet. It's possible we may come back later. I am going to Representative Bynum? Yep, briefities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We are back on record in House Finance on Thursday, the 29th. We heard and set aside SB 64. We're now resuming a hearing that started on Wednesday, the 27th. We were on slide 16, I think, Mr. Painter. The subject before us is the Legislative Finance Division overview of the governor's FY27 budget.
All right, Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. I think we had gone through the adjusted base items. We did the formula adjustments. And did we talk about slide 17, or did we leave off before talking about it? I don't remember. Cover it briefly, anyway. So we're continuing going through what's in the adjusted base, which is the kind of our clean starting point for the next year's budget. And in the adjusted base this year, the last series of changes are salary and benefits adjustments. And one thing I'd note is that we put these in the adjusted base because you can't pick and choose salary adjustments. You have an up or down decision, but they are a decision of the legislature. It's been decades since the legislature has rejected one, but it is a policy choice of the legislature to accept these. This year, right now, we have about $55 million of unrestricted general funds in salary adjustments, but there are five unions remaining still negotiating. The largest of these items is the health insurance rate, both for Alaska Care and for certain union trusts. There's also the PERS rate change, and that that is that the state as an employer pays the full actuarial cost of PERS, unlike other employers that have a cap. And so as that rate goes up, we have to pay more for state employees. There's also a series of cost of living adjustments that were negotiated. Note that a lot of these are based on an inflationary figure, 2.5%, and one is 3%. The reason for that is that several of the contracts that were negotiated that we're under right now specifically tied the COLA in FY27 to inflation rates. So a lot of them said if inflation is between certain amounts, that will give you a COLA of a certain amount. And a lot of them hit that threshold to hit that 2.5%, which matches roughly our inflation assumption. And the total fund impact is $111 million. And again, there's five unions still outstanding. They're not particularly large unions, unlike last year, but they do include the correctional officers and public safety state troopers and wildlife troopers that sometimes have gotten higher than inflationary increases due to recruitment concerns.
Mr. Painter, so I met with some staff of the university system today, and they said that I think the regents are calling for, tell me if they're wrong or I'm wrong, but $15 million in increases for salary adjustments, and the governor was funding like six. Does those numbers, are they about accurate?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The governor did not include funding in his budget for the non-covered employees, which the legislature also didn't include funding for last year. So this would be the second year if that continues. So the governor did not include that amount. And so you see that there's about $7 million in total funds, but there's nothing for the non-covered employees. And then there are three unions that are still negotiating as well.
Okay. So the governor recommends we authorize whatever the university system wants and it find the resources to bring parity to those uncovered. I mean, typically, I think the university wants to do for all the same.
Mr. Chairman, correct. And the legislature last year chose to not fund those and not give the increases to the uncovered amounts, employees. And I guess the governor is saying we should do the same for a second year in a row.
Yes. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Just on that same point, because of those dollar ratios of the regents asking for 15, the budget only having six, it related to the non-unionized staff. Can we conclude that there are more non-unionized employees at the university than there are in all of their unionized units because it's less than half?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I'm not confident in the numbers off the top of my head, and I'll get back to the committee with a more detailed answer. It may be that I included the health insurance for the university in this top bucket, and so the real total is higher, but I'll have to verify. I don't want to speculate on the record. So I'll get back to the
follow-up. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, because I heard the same numbers as Co-Chair Josephson this morning, and what struck me is I certainly don't think of those staff as being the lowest. I mean, I don't think of them as the highest paid employees at the university. And so I was trying to figure out why it was so disparate if we were paying all of the unionized staff, unless it includes all their administration also. So, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I think my hand came up after Representative Tomaszewski, so I defer to him if that's okay with you.
Fine with me. Okay. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. On that same group of folks, that did they not get a increase in salary last year? I think the university did come through with something for that particular non-unionized group of employees. Did they, or am I wrong in that assumption?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I'm trying to remember our answer in the that we got in the mid-year status report. I believe they did manage to find the funds, but I will verify and get back to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. Before we move on to the slide, I just wanted to kind of ask this question, because I get the question a lot about how we deal with the budget and what funds we are approving and which funds we aren't are not. Well, we ultimately approve, but we have control over. So as you'd indicated earlier, we have these union contracts that are going through from the executive in the university. They negotiate those contracts, and then they approve those contracts. And ultimately, those dollar amounts are being put into the budget. And then we have non-represented folks that fully depend upon the legislature, including those additional dollars upon request of the executive and the university, to make those funds available so that they can adjust wages. So can you just clarify specifically that process for the union contracts, those contracts being approved, and then the obligation that we have to then fund those contracts versus non-represented?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, so for covered employees, the legislature has delegated the power to negotiate the contracts to the Department of Administration and then the university for its unions. And those are brought to the legislature. The court has ruled that if we try to partially fund them, it's the same as defunding them. So there's language in the budget that says that by including the funding for this contract, we are approving the contract. If we did not want to approve a contract, we could not have the money and remove them from that language section. For non-covered employees of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, there is a statutory salary schedule. The current salary schedule was set to match the supervisory unit for a three-year period that is the length of their contract. So that is in statute. If we defund it, I suppose the agencies would just have to come up with the money because it is a statutory pay scale. For the university, it's a little bit different. And for state corporations, it's a little bit different. They're not in statute. So the boards and the Board of Regents or the Board of AHFC or whatever can make the decisions about the salaries, but if they don't have the resources, they often will not include the increases. So for AHFC, for example, when we passed the bill for non-covered employees, the board chose to make the increases as well, and we provided them with an appropriation to do so, but it wasn't automatic that that would happen. So it is a little bit disconnected, and there's not one system.
Is it a quick follow-up?
Yes, quick follow-up.
So for clarity, when you have those situations where an agreement has been reached and then the funding isn't provided, it's effectively saying that an agreement hasn't been reached. What does that do for the collective bargaining process?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it essentially sends them back to the negotiating table.
Thank you.
Before I hear from Representative Galvin, real quickly, with the uncovered cohorts, for example, the university, as a matter of policy, we could identify what number they assert or even the university asserts they would get were they given parity with the bargaining units. There's less compulsion to do it, But there's nothing as a matter of legislative prerogative that stops us from doing it, right? We don't need a CBA or a contract to fund those increases.
Mr. Chairman, that's right. And you can look in the university's Red Book and see those amounts, which is the Red Book is their budget request, and you can see those amounts.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And I just wanted to add to the conversation because I, too, heard some reporting about how the university was having to manage when they did not receive the funds last year. And so I wanted to add and put onto record, if I may, that when I asked, well, then how did you make it happen when you wanted to make sure that the university employees who were not under contract were able to stay? And what they did in this is the University of Alaska Anchorage system, which is approximately 60% of all of UA students. They had funds set aside to improve a large number of classrooms that needed it because they could not seat the number of students that they wanted to, and they couldn't do it appropriately. They set that project aside. They also did not fill approximately 50 positions that were vacant. And what that looks like to the student life is that means fewer class offerings. That also meant they're concerned about their security. There's a whole bunch of different things that happens when the university had to shift funds in order to make that happen. I just wanted to make sure we're aware of that, as I know we all care about the student experience at the university. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Let's go to slide 18.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, this brings us to the fiscal summary of the governor's FY27 budget and FY26 budget as well. So starting with FY26, we talked about yesterday the post-transfer deficit before any supplementals in FY26 is about $51 million. The governor's supplementals released on December 11th total just shy of $240 million. In addition, we are aware of a $55 million of fire suppression disasters that have been declared, not yet in a bill. That leads to a post-transfer deficit of $345.9 million in FY26. Note that that does include the $129.6 million to repay the higher ed fund. That is part of the post-transfer deficit because that's coming from the CBR. And that does not include other items that we are expecting in the governor's supplemental bill when it's released next week, including the Medicaid amount that we mentioned earlier and potentially other smaller items. So we would expect that that number will grow when we get the governor's full supplemental bill. In FY27, you can see that agency operations are virtually flat. Statewide items are also pretty similar. The capital budget is also virtually flat. Where the growth is between the years is that the governor is appropriating a full statutory dividend. This estimate is a little dated now. There's a slightly higher estimate that the APFC has come out based on actual revenue through, I think, December, where they're running a little ahead of the forecast. So they're currently projecting a slightly higher number, but this is what's in the governor's bill, so that's what we're using here. That leaves you with a deficit of just over $1.5 billion in FY27, very similar to the governor's proposal last year. And the governor proposes to fill both the FY26 and 27 deficits by drawing from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The balance at the beginning of FY26 is estimated to be about $3.3 billion. When you add new settlements and investment revenue, we'd project that to be about $3.4 billion available for FY26. So combined, these two draws are about half of the value of the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Okay. Mr. Painter, on the subject of the fire suppression disasters, if the governor's position, and maybe I hope this is just an academic matter and not one that gets into separation of powers and therefore is relevant for generations to come, one of those debates. But the governor's position was there was a disaster declaration and therefore he could spend beyond what was appropriated. I don't think anyone objects because they're disaster declarations. And our position, I think, although we haven't approved a budget or adopted this version even, but our position is no, we need to appropriate that. It strikes me that it literally comes down, either way it's dollars. Right, we're funding the same dollars to the same amount. Is there some reason beyond that, that we should engage in a debate over semantics?
Mr. Chairman, I don't view the terminology debate as particularly important, I suppose. I think the total is important and making sure that we account for the proper total. And I think the governor, by including the $55 million in their fiscal summary but not their bill, the intent is to try to have as accurate a fiscal summary as possible, and we appreciate that even though it wasn't in their bill. And if they bring forward a refined number that treats the $55 million as a ratification or treats it as a supplemental, it doesn't really matter as long as the money goes into the fund. Either way, I think everybody agrees that money can't be spent without an appropriation. A ratification is just kind of a term for an appropriation that has already been made in some ways, and you're putting it in. Historically, there were some ratifications for fire suppression 10, 12 years ago that were in the current year, but more recently we've tried to do appropriations. So it's not, I wouldn't view it as hugely important. My bigger complaints about the fire suppression disaster process was that they declared a disaster in November when there were no fires burning. I don't think that quite matches what the statute says. But that's more of a legal than a fiscal issue.
Okay. Let's go to slide 19.
So the next couple of slides are a couple of visual representations of the governor's budget. This first one is often called the swoop graph. It compares on the left the size of agency budgets in the FY26 management plan, and on the right the size of those budgets in the FY27 governor's budget. And a couple of notes on here. One, most of these items are fairly similar from year to year. Second, we do treat capital budget and statewide items as an agency for this purpose, just to try to keep this a little tighter. So the capital budget here of $157 million is reflected around the middle of the page. Another note is that we include the Department of Agriculture in this because it's part of the governor's budget, and the amount for FY26 is the amount that was in the Division of Agriculture in FY26, so to try to keep kind of some parity across the years. And happy to answer any questions or just keep moving.
Let's go to slide 20.
Okay, so slide 20 is another visual representation of the budget. This is showing UGF only, comparing the sources of our revenue in FY27 to the places they go. Our largest source of revenue in FY27 is that POMV draw of nearly $4 billion. The next largest in the governor's budget is actually the deficit draw from the CBR, then petroleum revenue, non-petroleum revenue. I think sometimes it can be useful to look at this for the relative size to get kind of an idea of just the relative size of the contributions of these things. I think sometimes people underestimate how important petroleum revenue still is compared to non-petroleum revenue, that, you know, it's even with these low prices, it's still twice as much as all of our non-petroleum revenue in UGF. Then on the right, you can see the agency operations. It's by far the largest part of the UGF budget at $4.77 billion, and then the governor's PFD, statewide items, and the capital budget.
Slide 21.
Okay, going on to agency operations. So the governor's agency operations are very close to adjusted base, $11 million over. The largest decrease that we see is in Medicaid. The FY26 budget included a temporary increment for FY26 and 27 of $10 million for behavioral health rates. The governor removed that from the FY27 budget, so terminated that temporary increment 1 year early. Mm-hmm. In the Department of Transportation, we have $6.5 million of UGF to replace one-time fund sources that were used in the FY26 budget. And there's another $1.4 million that we expect to come in GovMN because it appears to have just been a technical error to not replace that one. There's $5.2 million of UGF to replace restorative justice funds that are unavailable. The restorative justice funds are used to be called the PFD felon funds. They're the amount of the PFD that would go to people who are convicted of a felony, so they're not eligible. Instead, that's used in a number of areas of state government. In some of those areas, it's replacement funding for UGF, so when the restorative justice amount goes up, UGF goes down and vice versa. In this case, because of the lower PFD last year, that means less restorative justice funds available this year, and therefore adding UGF. Finally, the other large item on here is the IT class study that was initiated a number of years ago and is in a draft form now. The Office of Management and Budget included amounts all across state agencies for that. For classified employees, not for exempt employees, so we may see future adjustments for IT employees in the legislature, judiciary, governor's office, corporations, et cetera, that are not classified employees. They're not included yet, but for parity, they will likely have these increases in the future. And I'm highlighting it here mostly because every single subcommittee you'll have, other than the governor, legislature, and judiciary, are going to have this item in front of you.
Okay. Agency operations up, but cuts in other items and net were $1 million apart from the previous year?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Have you ever had or seen in your career of that sort of, you know, absence of a gap, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the closest we've seen to a flat budget in terms of within $1 million, yeah. Okay.
All right. Let's go to slide 22.
Slide 22 moves on to the statewide items. These are actually below the adjusted base. And remember, for statewide items, the adjusted base adjusts formulas for the new amounts. The biggest difference between the adjusted base and the governor's proposal is in the PERS and TERS contributions, the public employees retirement system and teachers retirement system. The governor is not fully funding the amount recommended by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. When I had the slide earlier about the PERS rates for state employees, he is fully funding the ARM Board's recommendation for the state as an employer, but is not fully funding it for the amount the state pays on behalf of other employers. The result of this, essentially, the ARM Board was looking at four different ways that they could – actually, I think they had six options of ways to fund the retirement system. They chose one. The governor chose a different one than what the ARM Board recommended, and it results in a lower funding amount. And if we followed the path that the governor has in mind, we would have lower payments now but higher payments in the future because we eventually do have to make those payments. The ARM Board had recommended trying to front-load a bit more of those payments because it results in lower total payments if we – put more up front.
Okay.
The governor fully – sorry, was there a question before I move on? Or?
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Joseph Sand, through the chair. So what was the recommended total of the ARM Board recommended?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't remember the total. The difference is $37.7 million, but I don't remember the total amount off the top of my head. I can get back to the committee with that.
Okay, thank you.
It's something like $250 million? Or
something in that range, yes.
Okay. So let's talk about school bond debt reimbursement.
Sure. So the governor fully funds school bond debt reimbursement and the REAA fund. Last year, the legislature and the governor, through a veto, funded those at 75% roughly of their estimated amount. The governor is fully funding them. One thing to note in that is that in the governor's budget, it's an estimated amount. There's some municipalities that plan to go out for debt. If they go out for that debt, likely that does not change the FY27 amount because there's a bit of a delay between when they vote on the debt and when they start having to make payments. So that's probably not going to move around, but there is some potential that new debt could change that number.
So even though one could argue times are tougher now than they were 12 months ago, the governor vetoed down to 75%. This coming year, he wants 100%.
Mr. Chairman, he actually only vetoed the REAA fund. So the legislature funded the school debt at 75%, but fully funded the REAA fund. And the statute is a little ambiguous about the timing of that because the REAA fund is supposed to be tied to the trailing year of school debt. So the legislature fully funded the REAA fund last year, I guess with the intention to partially fund it this year. The governor instead vetoed last year to match, so they match in the same year. That's been a more typical way to do that, is to have them match in the same year, even though the statute's the other way, subject to appropriation, so it's kind of an academic debate about which is which.
All right, let's look at the third item.
So the next item is the Community Assistance Fund. Last year, the legislature funded the amount needed to make a $20 million payment. The governor this year is putting in $14 million from the PCE fund and no unrestricted general funds. That amount would result in an $18 million payment to communities. That's less than the amount of the base payment, so those would be prorated, and no per capita payments because those would come above that amount as well.
When I first got to the legislature, the previous year's payments, I think 2012, were $90 million, and now we're looking at $18 million. Does that sound familiar?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, yes.
Co-Chairman Foster.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Painter, so you've got $14 million here from the PCE fund. So this is a non-standard thing, correct? This is because normally what happens, the PCE fund spits off earnings which go to pay PCE benefits throughout the state and rural Alaska, and I think I'm guessing that's like $15 million a year or something like that. This amount, this $14 million, is to go to community assistance. Is that what this is doing here?
Through the Chair, Representative Foster, so there is a statutory waterfall allowing PCE funds to go to community assistance based on available earnings. There's a bit of disagreement between us and the Office of Management and Budget how much that statutory waterfall would pay out. When the PCE fund was moved to the Permanent Fund Corporation, there probably should have been a statutory adjustment to that waterfall calculation because of the different way the permanent fund deals with investment management fees versus treasury. So we would say to meet the spirit of the statute, we should deduct management fees, and the true number should be like $12.6 million versus the $14 they have. But again, it's a subject to appropriation thing. You can't get an attorney to weigh in on it because they'll say you can do whatever you want. But it is statutory allowable. We don't quite agree on the exact amount. It's not a huge difference.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Painter. Okay, good. That's good to know. I was aware of the waterfall. I just thought this was something that was outside the waterfall. Sounds like the amount is still something that's up for debate, which is new to me, and I didn't know that, and I'll look more into that. So thank you very much.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. I appreciate you bringing up this this term waterfall again, and the mechanisms that we use that we're using to cascade, you know, unspent dollars into other areas where we spend dollars or transfer dollars. And so I'd look forward to the opportunity to get with you outside of this venue here to really talk about those statutory structures that allow those things to happen. I would say that maybe I'm wrong in this assessment, but it feels like we've put these statutory mechanisms in place for these waterfalls that basically take appropriating controls out of our hands to just say, well, let the system just take care of itself, and we may or may not see that those things are happening unless we really pay attention. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk further about that outside of here.
Through the chair, Representative Biden, one comment I'll make is last year the legislature did not follow the statutory waterfall. We funded less than the full amount from PCE to be able to free up those funds for other purposes, essentially.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And then the last two items?
So the last two items on here are items that there's not a statutory formula for how much we should put in. Those are the fire suppression fund. The governor's figure here matches the post-veto pre-supplemental FY26 amount. And the disaster relief fund amount, that is larger than the post-veto pre-supplemental amount, very close to the legislature's pre-veto number for FY26. I think the OMB director mentioned that it's based on a 10-year average. We haven't seen the calculations to know if we agree with the average or not. But, again, there's no statutory formula, so they're just a subtraction item.
And is that because we're waiting on final numbers for FY26, we couldn't be waiting on that?
Mr. Chairman, for fire suppression, it's difficult to know what fires will burn. Legislative finance has generally advocated for funding somewhere close to the average amount of fire costs to try to reduce supplementals. But this amount is a bit below the average. We don't really know at this point whether this looks like an above-average or below-average fire season. Last year, I think the legislature was concerned that due to low snowpack, we were looking at a above-average fire season, which was indeed the case. This year, I don't think we know yet. For disaster relief, we don't know what disasters are going to happen next year. The supplemental kind of takes care of the known disasters that have already occurred, so using some sort of average for the future unknown disasters is probably a reasonable approach for that as well.
Okay. Representative Hannon for Mr. Painter.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Mr. Painter, let me just, in my mind, it's not the, are we funding the average or 50% of the average?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair.
Pre-supplemental.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, Representative Hannon, for the disaster relief fund, the OMB asserts that it's the 10-year average. I think we just haven't verified that calculation to know, but that's and what then, they said. Okay. The fire suppression, we're at about $27 million under the average. It's not a fixed percentage.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Slide 23.
Okay. Moving on to the capital budget. So the governor's capital budget is largely matching funds and not a whole lot of unrestricted general fund projects that are kind of state priorities, I suppose. So about 81% of it is general fund match being used to match federal dollars. Primarily that's in federal highways and aviation, and then the DEC's Village Safe Water Program. There's $22.9 million of AHFC dividends going back to their own projects. That's a little bit less than their board recommendation of $28.7 million. I would note that they had an above average year of dividends, so their total dividend is 50-something million. So the remainder of the unspent dividend just goes back to the general fund as UGF revenue. The governor's mental health capital budget, which is in the mental health bill, not in the capital bill, just so it travels with the operating budget, has $1.9 million of UGF GF mental health. That compares to $6.5 million recommended by the Mental Health Trust. There are two UGF projects that are not either HFC dividends match or GF mental health. They're both in fish and game, and both are continuations of prior year projects relating to salmon. There's no funding in the governor's budget for school construction or major maintenance, and there's $26 million from the Alaska Capital Income Fund for deferred maintenance on state facilities. To give you an idea of the scale of that, in FY24, there were $14.6 billion of state facilities between the state and the University of Alaska, and 2% of that, which is sort of a conservative number for how much ongoing maintenance and operations you'd need, would be $292 million. So we're at something like 10% of that, so, you know, 0.2% of our facility value. And school construction and major maintenance, some of that will be handled through the school debt reimbursement program if districts go out to bond. Some will be handled through the REA fund, but there's no additional funds on top of those for those projects.
So I always thought of the school construction major maintenance. When I think of bonding, I think of new stuff. And you're saying that the governor's funding none of the old stuff and will fund up to, I guess, the requirements of the new items that are bonded.
Mr. Chairman, correct.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. You know, this is obviously a very concerning number that I see every year that I've been here, which isn't very long, but I know that it's been going on much longer, is this idea that we aren't making investment in our capital outside of match. And I know that I do believe that this number does reflect all the available match that we are trying to get. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes.
Or let me rephrase that, not that we're trying to get, that we're eligible for. With that being said, though, I see here that we do have some of the agencies and institutions have recommendations for what they'd like to see in investment for capital, specifically non-match capital. Do we as a whole, from a department by department level, have recommendations that they'd like to see that's not being funded, or is this just a general rule of thumb that we know that we need to be making more capital investment, but, you know, given priorities of the budget, that we're not making this a priority?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we essentially only know the agency requests when there's an independent board or something like that that's giving the request. So we know, for example, the judiciary has a couple of capital projects that they put forward that are not included in the governor's capital budget, and that the university had a number of capital projects that their board of regents put forward that are not in the governor's capital budget. I highlighted these two because they're kind of partially funded, but there's those other items that were put forward by their respective boards or the Supreme Court, in the case of the judiciary, that are not funded at all as well. When they come from state agencies, we don't know what requests they might make of the Office of Management and Budget that don't come to us. But when they're independent and public, we can at least highlight them for you.
Appreciate that.
Ms.
I was just going to say thank you for the opportunity to speak on that, Mr. Chairman. But, you know, I hope that we as a committee and then we as a body in the House will take a stronger look at how we can start making investment in Alaska because I believe that we are woefully underfunding what we need to be doing in capital, and it has a negative impact not only on my community in District 1, but I'm certain it has a negative impact on all of our communities throughout the state. So I challenge us, Mr. Chairman, that that's something that we take a strong focus and effort and look on, and I know the co-chair next to me here is going to be heading that process, so I look forward to the strong debate about that.
Well, we're the governor's recommending appropriating 10% of 2% of deferred maintenance. That strikes me as dire. On the question of the judiciary and its requests, both in the operating and capital, so I have a memo. It's got addenda to it from the Hickel era, the first governor Hickel era, I think it is, that says when a governor, any governor, receives a judiciary's budget, that governor is supposed to walk to a copy machine, hit the green button, and put whatever is on that paper into his budget as a preliminary matter, just a preliminary matter. Did that happen this year?
Mr. Chairman, it has not happened for the last couple of years. And on the capital side, that hasn't happened consistently. It's really the operating budget where that agreement has held over the years. But the last 2 years, that agreement has not held. And so, you know, when we receive the governor's budget at Ledge Finance, we reach out to the judiciary and say, are there any items, you know, we asked this year, are there any items that weren't put forward? They gave us the list, and they're included in our subcommittee book for the judiciary. On the capital side, we made the request. They're included in our capital overview for the judiciary, so you can see those items. But again, they didn't come through OMB this year.
I have a question about your second bullet here on the AHFC dividends. So the board said, we recommend spending more dividends on its recommendations. What do we glean from the fact that they're proposing to spend less than the board wanted? I don't understand. There's an underlying message here I'm not getting.
Mr. Chairman, AHFC dividends do count as unrestricted general funds. They can be used for any purpose. That's kind of a matter of course. We often appropriate them in the capital budget back to AHFC so that they can control the cash flow, rather than if they're transferred to the general fund, you know, they don't get to bond on that or anything. It's just a cost savings. I mean, the largest item of reduction is the homeless assistance program, for example. But it's just there's a series of those items we highlight in our capital overview for DOR that governor just chose not to fund to save money, I suppose.
Okay, slide 24.
So another item thing to highlight is what's not yet in the budget. And the items here are things that are kind of known. I tried to make a Donald Rumsfeld reference in the other body, and they did not understand it. So maybe this committee gets it. But these are sort of the known knowns. These are the things that we know are coming. It's a matter of when. So the first is Medicaid. On December 15th, the Medicaid projection came from the Department of Health that anticipates an additional $47.4 million of UGF is needed for FY27 to make up the Medicaid program. That's not in the governor's budget because of timing concerns. That's been the case for the last few years. They used to put in a preliminary number and true it up later. This way, they don't put anything in but then provide the good number at the same time. It doesn't really matter as long as we know what number we're getting to, in my opinion. But we do know that $47.4 million is coming. That does not include any increases related to rate rebalancing studies. So I think some of you probably have heard about this already, but the Department of Health has been working with a contractor to look at their rates more holistically because a lot of their rate methodologies have required pretty blunt tools for adjusting their rates. So there may be a particular service that has a low rate relative to others, but they haven't had the ability to raise just that rate. They'd have to raise an entire class of rates. So, for example, the contractor pointed out that the rates for autism services in Alaska are too low to have sufficient provision of those services. And so right now, if the Department of Health wanted to adjust that, they'd have to adjust all behavioral health rates up, but not all of them need the same level. So the contractor went and looked at those in a more granular way and said, how could we rebuild the rates from the ground up? What would be a process for that, and what amounts would be needed? And so there's these four studies that have recommendations. They don't necessarily need to be implemented now or all at once, but they do have a series of recommendations that I think are worthy of the committee's time to see those recommendations. And that's not included in this $47.4 million or in the governor's budget at all right now. And those amounts are in the tens of millions of general funds for this year alone. So, again, putting it on people's radar, but that's a little unknown what exactly you would want to do if we had the funds available to do.
Let me interrupt you real fast on that. My sense from talking to the Department of Health is that in FY27, we may not see that work yet. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chairman,
on the rate rebalancing?
We do have the studies.
Right. We have the Guidehouse studies.
Right.
But no final regs or rulemaking has been done? Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, right. And the question would be, based on the likely timing, would some portion of that need to be in the FY27 budget, like starting the next calendar year, for example? It's unclear. They're still working through that process, and that's why it's not in the budget anywhere. But, again, something to sort of look at, I think, through the legislative process this year about whether you'd like to push for that and how much.
Okay. Let's go on to the ongoing employee bargaining.
As I mentioned earlier, there's five unions still negotiating, so that's something to keep in mind. Not particularly huge ones. So last year I think we had a pretty large placeholder for ongoing negotiations. This year, if we made one up, it'd be significantly lower. Another one to put on your radar would be the SNAP administrative cost match. So in the in HR1 or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, there are two provisions related to SNAP. One is sort of this known item that for every state, the state's match share for administrative costs for SNAP is going to increase in federal fiscal year 27 from 25 to 50%. Department of Health estimates that would cost an additional $10.7 million. That's not in the governor's budget right now. Maybe we'd only need three quarters of a year because of the timing offset. But again, that's not here now. We may see it in GovAmend, or they may not address it for now. Related to that, there are other provisions in that bill that may increase the workload for the Division of Public Assistance. There's not additional positions there right now. In the current year, the department has used their cross-appropriation transfer authority to bring money into the Public Assistance Division, but that's not reflected on an ongoing basis. So there may need to be budget adjustments there if you want to ensure there's sufficient staffing. But again, that's not yet really in the budget. It may be coming in GovAmend, but I can't be sure. Another item to put on the committee's radar that's smaller, so it's not on the slide relating to the Department of Health, is the TANF program, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That we've in the past had a multi-year language item to provide additional maintenance of effort funding if needed. The last time we had it in was $3 million. And those funds are all completely expended now, and they're not being replaced in the governor's budget. And we had asked about that, whether that was necessary or forthcoming, and it's unclear if it's forthcoming or not, but it likely is necessary to keep that program meeting its maintenance of effort. And just as a general note, over the last 6 years, the governor's amended budget is on average about $100 million higher than the December release. This year, Medicaid would be about half of that, so that seems like a reasonable enough placeholder if you're trying to figure out what might come in GovAmend. That's just been the historical norm, and it's important when we're in this phase in January to realize that more items are still forthcoming.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Painter. So regarding the admin costs, and again, we can get into the payment error rate. I know it's on the next slide later. So a couple of years ago, legislature passed a bill that dramatically increased eligibility for SNAP. It was supposed to be followed with broad-based category eligibility for administration. The second part, the BC, did not come to fruition, getting changes in the federal guidelines. So is there any way that we could potentially look at what our administrative cost increase would be in the event that if the eligibility increase was unwound? So rather than $10.7 million, if we could determine that, and also proportional with the potential fine for payment error rate, if we took proportionality of that. And second half of that request is going to be, what is the minimum eligibility for the program that we're required by federal law? I know it's probably health department too. So thanks.
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, did you want me to get back to the committee, or is that something you're just putting on the radar?
Just if you could get back. I know you're not going to know the answer, but at some point. Thank you.
Will do.
Representative Galvin.
I had similar questions.
Mr. Painter, this is the, I think, most concerning page in your deck, although we're still got a little ways to go. Didn't we, or didn't the governor ask for 15 eligibility techs for SNAP? And isn't that, you were talking about how there's no more personnel or something, and I'm paraphrasing, but isn't there some cavalry coming there?
Mr. Chairman, there's some being transferred, not using new money, but moving from elsewhere within the department. They are transferring more in there. A lot of that is to replace the defunding by the legislature last year of the virtual call center. So it's not necessarily additional staff over what they had previously. It's hiring staff to replace the contractor that they had with the VCC prior.
Okay. So you've identified that if expected supplementals are paid for, we're out of balance with our normal cash flow and the draw in FY27, and these are on top of that deficit.
Mr. Chairman, so in FY27 we have the $1.5 billion deficit. These would come on top of that.
But I'm setting that aside
right
for now. I guess I'm talking about an adjusted base budget.
Yeah.
These expenditures on slide 24 are on top of those.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yeah. All right. Slide 25.
Okay, so now we're moving on to the known unknowns. These are things that are other items to put on your radar that I don't know if they're something to worry about or not. I just want to make sure that as your financial advisor by statute, I'm making sure you're aware of potential fiscal issues. So one of those is the federal disparity test with the K-12 formula. The governor's budget assumes that we pass the disparity test for both FY26 and 27. Currently, we have failed the FY26 test, but we are appealing that. It's unclear when that appeal will be resolved and if we will be successful. For FY27, we have not yet submitted the test. If we fail, the additional amount would be about $79 million in FY26 and $71 million in FY27. The appropriation language in the governor's bill and in the enacted FY26 budget automatically would increase for that amount. So I want to put it on your radar because there's no action that would be needed, but if we fail the disparity test, the budget would go up by those amounts without us taking any additional action. So when you're trying to figure out what's the need from the CBR in FY26 potentially, that item would just go up without any action. So you could end up where you funded enough for the projected items, and if there's a cap on that amount, it might defund that, but that would just lead to a shortfall. So I want to put that on your radar as something to keep in mind as you're trying to balance the budgets for the next 2 years. Another would be the Alaska Marine Highway System. So for the last 3 years, that budget has relied on Federal Transit Administration's Rural Ferry Program. Typically, that grant application goes out in the spring, and we know our award by the fall. That grant application for the award that we are relying on for the calendar year 26 budget has not yet gone out. Typically, that would have gone out last spring. We don't know why. The Department of Transportation does not know why. It takes several months to process, so we may not know during this session how much of that grant we're getting. We have $5 million of UGF backstop for calendar year 26, but we're still relying on nearly $78 million of federal funding for AMHS in calendar year 26, and it's not necessarily guaranteed that we're going to get it if that grant application does not come out, because this federal administration has been known to withhold grant applications at times. Perhaps we have a bigger hole. The governor is proposing to change to a multi-year approach for the AMHS budget. So instead of continuing with the calendar years, he has multi-years on the fiscal year basis. His FY27-28 calendar year budget or fiscal year budget relies on $83.3 million from this fund because it doesn't have any backstop. And so those could become budget holes in FY26 and 27, or really, given the timing of that calendar year 26 item, they would run out of money if they don't get the grant more into FY27, but part of that calendar year 26 budget that we appropriated last year. So the timing gets a little confusing about when we'd pay for that. One piece of good news with that, though, is that the Tustamina replacement that was appropriated, the last funds of which were appropriated last year, was relying on already awarded capital funds. So that is not at risk. That is out to bid. We have that money in hand, so that's not at risk. It's really just those remaining 2 years of funds that are unknown at this point. And even if we get those funds when we're building next year's budget, next session, those funds are expiring. Congress is expected to take up a transportation bill as soon as this fall, so perhaps we'll know if that's going to continue in some form or not. But right now, it's just something to put on your radar building the budget next year that we may have a hole, even if those grants do come out for FY 26 and 27. Finally, as Representative Stapp alluded to, there's the SNAP match for the program itself. That is based on our error rate and would likely begin in FY 28, although it could be delayed based on a waiver process. The amount could vary. It could be between $15 and $46 million, according to the department. And again, it won't hit until next year, so it's not really an issue to think about as much this year, although you may want to make sure we can get the error rate down by fully staffing that division. But we can't necessarily – we don't need to appropriate funds now. I just want to make sure it's on everybody's radar, and knowing kind of the scope of that or the scale of that amount based on the Department of Health's previous projections.
Yeah. But the fact that we're not preparing for FY 28, other than what you've noted about error rates, there's no set-aside. There's no bucket to prepare for FY 28 is more reflection of our position.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, one comment I'd make before we if I can, is, on one of the slides that we covered yesterday or the day before, whenever it was, I noted that the PMV draw this year went up by $200 million. That's an unusually large amount. That's not going to be the case in FY 28. So if we think this year it's tough to balance the budget, FY 28, where we have more of these budgetary headwinds and don't have that $200 million increase to the PMV draw, will likely be more difficult. And so I just want to keep that in mind, that we may be able to make things work this year more easily than next year.
It's the we that's interesting for me. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I wasn't going to comment on this because I know that Representative Stapp has already asked questions, but I just want to make sure that we note that for 28, my understanding is we need to reduce down to 6% error rate. We're presently at 24 error rate. We're doing a lot better than we were. We were at 51 or so, and part of that was consciously decided in order to make sure we're feeding Alaskans. And so I appreciate all of that. But when I hear that you're saying that there are no more new opportunities to, or at least new employees in that, doing that work in SNAP, that's a concern. And I appreciate our thinking about investing now so that we can be ready for what's to come and lessen the impact of that sort of a fine.
Representative Stapp, did you have a question? Sorry.
Please, go ahead.
Should you need to answer, Rep. Galvin?
No, it was a comment.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Through the co-chair to Director Painter. AMH funding FY 26, assuming we use multi-year like receipt authority language to kind of stretch this, kind of what is our drop dead date here for FY 26? Because obviously they're in a October year, we're on a June 1. If we do not have the money on hand by June 1, what happens in FY 26 to the operations of the ferry system?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So they have, I think, about 58% of their budget right now. The question is, if the department is trying to make management decisions about do they need to make their budget stretch or not, I'm not sure at what point they need to make those decisions. That's really a management and policy call that I can't answer what the department will do. Because if they do nothing and we get no grant, they'll be out of money in, 58% of the year, like August, something like that. So they could reduce operations to try to make up that hole, or we could provide funds, or they could count on the grant, but then potentially we'd just stop sailing at some point. So it really is a management question of how would DOT choose to react to that. And I really can't answer that, but DOT can probably provide more insight into their thinking.
Okay, follow up, Mr.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, through the chair, to Director Painter. So you had mentioned the fact that there's a delay in the application and the award process. So if we were guesstimating, obviously your budget's generally done around May here, and what would be, like, if there's no, let's say, news by, let's say, April 15th or April 20th or something like that, like, then should we think of legislative action, basically, on this item, in your opinion, through the chair?
Mr. Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Staff. I mean, I think at this point, unless the grant comes out within the next few weeks, it would be unlikely that we would know before the budget's already in the conference committee. So, you know, how you handle that is a big policy question. You know, put an item in as a placeholder and maybe we can take it out later, or not put it in. And, you know, if you go to the governor's proposal that essentially starts the next year on July 1st, we actually don't really have a hole yet, but it would leave a very large hole next year, because instead of a two-year multi-year, you're going to use up a lot of that in the current year rather than sort of operating on a delay. So, you know, following the governor's budget, it's not necessarily an immediate hole, but it would be a much larger hole next year if we didn't get the grant. So, you know, that makes sense. There's a number of kind of layered decisions here, so it's not as easy of an answer as I wish it could be.
Last follow-up, Mr.
Last Returns. Follow-up. Yeah. The step.
So through the chair to Director Payne. Yeah, obviously. So I guess the only thing that I don't quite get about the executive's proposal is how you're basically stretching FY26 dollars so far out. I mean, I know that we can do interesting things with multi-year language, but it kind of feels like mathematically they got to have to run out of money unless they get the funding, and just because if we slide that into FY28 through multi-year language, that doesn't necessarily mean they actually get the money, right? I mean, like, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Staff. So the advantage in this case of starting with the multi-year is that instead of the new year starting on, you know, January 1st next year, we'd be bumping it up. So when we switch to the 18-month or to the calendar year, we had one year where we had a lot of federal funds for COVID that could only be used for a few things. So we pushed out, we had a year in the budget where we had an 18-month Marine Highway budget. And essentially in this case, we could be using that and pushing back. So using that advantage that we gained, you know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago and kind of pushing that back. That would be the advantage of going to that proposal. But again, then instead of the 27-28 proposal actually funding 28, it'd be funding just 27. So
thanks.
Might be a problem.
Representatives Hannon and then Bynum. We have a hard stop at 3:15.
Thank you, Co-Chair. And I was just going to remind the committee on this AMHS issue that we did move them to a calendar year. So we're saying FY26, but they have calendar 26. So they have authorization to spend through December. But the grant that's not in place and hasn't been advertised, and believe you me, when I got the budget books and did my meet as the subcommittee chair, we pressured them on this issue. The higher-ups from DOT expect to be in D.C. the first week of March. They're hoping to have an answer, but the advertisement period for the grant had been a 3 to 4 month process. So even if it came out that week that they're there, we are unlikely to know before we adjourn. And if we went to a multi-year beyond calendar year, it's the, you know, always sort of our concern here last year was we're just potentially stretched, digging a bigger hole right now and pushing it off. I have deep concerns about how we're going to keep sailing to communities if we don't get this grant, if the grant doesn't materialize.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and given the time constraints, I'll take my question offline.
Okay. Mr. Painter, just on the AMHS issue, if the monies are withheld for some unknown reason, what we see with our sister states is that they litigate, but I don't see how that would happen in Alaska. I mean, who could challenge the failure to deliver the grant?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer a legal question.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Representative Hannon.
Co-Chair, I believe in the cases you're reflecting on, the grants had been awarded and not given. This grant is not even advertised. This is what we thought we would get in a grant if it's advertised and we compete for it. It's still a competitive grant. So maybe we got $50 million. That'd be great in this scenario because right now we've got $80 million that we're hoping for, and there isn't even a grant program out there. So we haven't been awarded it, so it wouldn't seem that we could litigate on money that was never advertised and we didn't get.
Thank you. That's helpful to me. All right, let's go on to slide 26.
Okay, so now we're moving on to the longer-term view. So this graph goes back to FY14 because this kind of defines our current fiscal era. When oil prices declined starting in FY15, our revenue decreased significantly, but we were actually already running a bit of a deficit in FY14, even with prices well over $100 a barrel. And when we adopted the percent of market value draw in FY19, we went from having, you know, a $3 billion a year deficit to smaller deficits for a couple of years, and then have run roughly balanced budgets from FY21 through 26 on average. We've had a couple of years with surpluses in 22 and 24, and then a few years with deficits. But on the whole, we've sort of made things work from year to year. I've called it the muddle-through fiscal plan, where each year we sort of see, well, what's our available revenue? How much does that mean we can afford for a capital budget and PFD? Obviously, that has some long-term costs. Our agency operations are, in an inflation-adjusted manner, 16.6% below our peak year of FY15, and we've not funded deferred maintenance at anything approaching a sustainable level since FY14. So it's been quite a few years of underfunding, and we have not funded the statutory PFD amount in a decade now, so obviously there's a lot of uncertainty, which I think ICER talked about uncertainty a little bit in their presentation this morning. The muddle-through fiscal plan has a lot of uncertainty because it's going to vary. We're going to have years where we have a large dividend and energy rebate and large capital budget, and then years where we have a very small dividend like this year. And that's been kind of our fiscal reality for the last 5 years or so, where we just make things work from year to year. One advantage of making it work is that we've gone from the time where we were drawing through our savings accounts to starting to rebuild a balance slowly but surely. So we started in FY14 with nearly $16 billion in our two main savings accounts, the constitutional and statutory budget reserves. By FY20, those were down below $2 billion. We had drawn quite a bit there, and now they're up above $3 billion. So we're starting to go in the positive direction just because investment earnings are outpacing the draws when we do have deficits and deposits. We've had a couple of years with significant deposits as well because of the surpluses. So we are heading in the right direction now on those savings balances. But again, that's because we're sort of just managing year by year rather than having a comprehensive fiscal plan.
Next slide.
Another item that we've talked about a few times is, given that the POMV draw is our largest source of revenue now, will there be enough money in the earnings reserve account to make sure that we can make that payment each year? And there's a bit of a structural issue in that the statutory net income projection is 6.2% compared to inflation of 2.5% and a POMV draw of 5%. You add those together, that's 7.5%, but we're getting 6.2%, right? So there's, as you see, a convergence of the lines. This graph on the bottom compares the year-end realized ERA balance, that's the spendable balance as of June 30, to the following year POMV. So what the permanent fund owes the general fund the next day, July 1st. And you don't want to see the red bar below the blue bar because that means you can't make your obligation until you've realized some more money. And we see that right now in FY26, it's actually the ERA is looking pretty healthy at about $12 billion. Part of that is because we did not inflation-proof in FY26. Part of it is that the fund performed better than projected in FY25. But we still see that convergence over time. Our probabilistic modeling shows a 33% chance of having an insufficient ERA balance to make the full POMV draw over the next decade, assuming full inflation proofing. We suspended inflation proofing when the ERA drops below the next year's POMV draw. That percentage drops to 24%. That's actually quite a bit better than when we ran this a year ago. Those percentages were 46% and 33%, respectively. The improvement is because of no inflation proofing and the strong earnings in FY25. So you accuse me of having no good news. This is good news. Things are better on this particular front.
Yeah.
Looking at revenue over the long term, the Department of Revenue's fall forecast projects that oil prices will rise slightly slower than inflation over the next decade, although the last few days have looked very positive because of geopolitical issues. Oil production is projected to actually increase from a bit over 500,000 barrels a day in FY27 to 659,900 barrels a day by FY35. However, oil revenue as a whole is not projected to grow that fast, and so we end up with sort of revenue just growing basically at the rate of inflation. And the reason for that is that we're losing production from our legacy fields, adding production in new fields that don't earn as much tax revenue. So royalties do go up, but the production tax revenue actually declines over this period in the revenue forecast. The permanent fund is projected to earn 7.3% per year, and just note that this does, we're using figures that match APFC's projections that came out a little bit after the revenue sources book, so they're slightly higher than the revenue sources book. And then we also were adjusting the NPRA royalties that we talked about the other day to remove the amounts from the general fund that, in Ledge Legal's view, are still federal funds. So the takeaway from this slide is that revenue is projected to grow roughly with inflation. That means if you cannot make the budget balance this year, there's no reason to think things are going to change without any structural changes. So getting to the long-term outlook, you know, it's pretty obvious that if you have $1.5 billion deficit and make no changes, that's not going to improve. Again, we've been making things work from a year to, on a year-to-year basis by not fully funding the PFD and by not funding a sustainable capital budget, for example. The governor's 10-year plan did not make significant policy changes, so it kind of kept this deficit in place. When I made this slide a few days ago, we hadn't had time to analyze the governor's fiscal plan. I don't have anything built in, but I will say that in very rough numbers, the governor's fiscal plan brings in about $900 million of new revenue at its peak, reduces the statutory PFD to the 50-50, which is about $400 million a year. That adds up to about $1.3 billion a year. That still does leave a deficit. So it's about $200 to $400 million, and then the governor's fiscal plan has some of the taxes starting to go away, so it increases in the out years. The governor also has a spending limit that limits the growth of government to 1%, so that's also incorporated into that 200 to 400% or $200 to $400 million gap that remains based on our modeling of it. We haven't seen modeling from them of their full fiscal plan. That's just based on the statutory pieces that he's introduced so far.
Can you take one last question?
No,
yes.
It's okay.
All right. Then I'll make mine the last question. Just to confirm, and I haven't seen you make an error maybe ever so far, so I just want to confirm, on slide 24, SNAP administrative costs, I thought we could forego that for a year with a pretty please letter. Perhaps that's just the match itself, not the administrative costs.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that's the match for the program, not the administrative costs, but I can double check.
Okay. Any other last-minute questions? Seeing none, I'd like to thank Mr. Painter for his presentation. I'm quite concerned about it. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, January 30th, 2026, at 1:30. At that meeting, the Department of Revenue will present on the state savings, reserves, and investments. With that, we'll adjourn this meeting at 3:16. Thank you.